Welcome to the Marketplace Roundtable podcast. We speak with Seeking Alpha Marketplace authors about their investing styles, their views on the market, and their favorite investing ideas. I'm your host, Nathaniel Baker. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so their readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. A full set of disclosures will be provided at the end of this podcast. For reference purposes, this podcast was recorded on Tuesday, October 22nd, 2019. I am joined today by longtime contributor to SeekingAlpha.com, Michael Wiggins de Oliveira. Michael has been an active participant on Seeking Alpha since 2014 and a professional investor going back to 2012. He is the founder of Deep Value Research, which is a premium research service that is highly selective on picking out undervalued, out of favor, and typically small cap stocks. Michael updates his track record on Seeking Alpha every day, and he now has a three-year track record that shows him beating the S&P since inception. That's since his inception, not since the S&P 500's inception. That would make him a lot older than he actually is. A subscription to the Deep Value Research Service gets you exclusive ideas and Michael's top five picks. This is a list of stocks that Michael invests with alongside his members. You can find out more on Seeking Alpha by searching for Deep Value Research. A free trial is available. Okay, let's get into it. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Why don't we start off and why don't you tell us a little bit about your investing strategy?
So I tried to adopt how Warren Buffett was doing his partnerships from 1956 to 1969, over those 13 years when he was hitting 30% returns. And what he was doing at the time, he was predominantly looking for something called net-nets. These are no longer available in the market nowadays. But the concept is pretty similar to what I do, which is buying distressed equity. And this essentially means that you're buying a company that's fallen out of favor. The outlook is grim. And that is why it's cheap. It's cheap because people don't want to own it at that particular time. The only thing I do that's slightly different from what Buffett did at the time is that I'm very much looking out for companies that are very free cash flow generative, and I'm trying to find very stable companies. So the stable aspect is very similar to what Buffett was doing, but he was not particularly looking for companies that generate a lot of free cash flow, because those in his view at the time would have been probably more expensive. But our market is so expensive right now that finding companies that trade cheaply, you have to compromise at some point.
Right. Okay. So you've been doing this for a little while, mm-hmm. 5 years on Seeking Alpha, mm-hmm. and 7 as a professional. What would you say is an important lesson that you've learned in this time about investing?
I think that the best lesson is that you're going to make a mistake. I mean, Buffett talks about the fact that if you're going to be really good at this game, you're going to have a 60% success rate. Peter Lynch, Monish Pabrai, Charlie Munger all say pretty much the same. You're going to fail 40% of the time. And I think that is the most important lesson to take away, because anytime you make an investment, so let's say ABC, and you think that you got this and you think that you're buying something at a discount, and you're going to fail. And I think that's, if you come in with that line of thinking that this could be the one that I fail on, I think that kind of gives you a bit of insight into kind of minimizing your downside risk.
Is there any way to minimize the mistakes or to avoid making them, perhaps?
I mean, it's the kind of thing that you say yes to, but it's yeah. fraud. It's just not possible. Mm. I think that you're going to fail. If you, for example, if you're Buffett and he goes into IBM, or Buffett going into Tesco, you're going to make a mistake. I mean, it's like it's part of the game. If you buff it with the Kraft Heinz merger, I mean, it happens, and it doesn't put a blemish, you know, on Buffett's track record, and it's going to happen. So I mean, I think that's the if nothing else to take away, I think that being humble enough to understand that you're going to fail 40% of the time, and in very few professions that you're allowed to fail so much and make like such big returns.
Yeah. And no risk, no reward, right? Nothing ventured, nothing gained.
I don't believe like that. I know it sounds kind of cool, but I think that for example, I'm the companies that I buy, they are very much free cash flow generative companies. And if you were an owner, not in the public market, but if you're owner of that company, even of all its problems, I think that you would still make a reasonable return. You might or might not beat the S&P, but I do not. I think that you need to, a person, an investor, needs to, if there's any chance in your mind before you go in that there is a that you're going to make a risk, you should just not get involved with that. You need to be extremely selective in what you pick. A huge, rock solid balance sheet. You need to be. It needs to be clean. You need to know that the business itself, the enterprise, has a huge staying power down 3, 5, 10 years on the road. So, but you might be paying too much for that business, and that's a whole different thing. But you need to kind of cap the downside on that side.
Very interesting. Okay. This has been an interesting year in markets. We've had a lot of ups and downs. The market is up, but there has been some pockets of volatility, as I said. What's your view on the market this year, and where do you see things going forward?
I mean, it's been a very, very rewarding year. I mean, everybody, I think, is coming out with gains in 2019. I mean, it's been a very, very strong year. I think that, you know, markets have bad times and markets have good times. We went through World War II, we went through 1987, went from the 1993 crisis, .com, 2008, you know, even some in small caps, at least in 2018, the fourth quarter, that was a bear market also. So there are periods when things go sour. And that, you know, that is fine as long as you understand that you're going to have to be investing for, let's say, 3, 4 years down the road. And if you're willing to do that, I think that even if you're, let's say, 65 or even 70, people are living for a while now. And I think even at that stage in the game, you can do a diversified portfolio of cheap companies. You do not, in my opinion, even if you're 60, you do not need to compromise on a 3% dividend on a IBM or something similar. I think that I think that even at that stage, I think that the risk reward of investing in something that has the illusion of a high dividend and then you come out with a permanent capital loss, I think that's more risky than saying, hey, either I'm not going to invest at all, which is fine, absolutely fine, or if I am going to invest, then I'm going to take a diversified portfolio and I'm going to seek out cheap companies. And I think that is really where the opportunity is. And I think that there's so much competition nowadays in the market. It's just from all over the globe. Everybody is competing. So I think that in hindsight, 2019 has been a very, very strong year.
So do you subscribe to Buffett's idea that that businesses should reinvest in themselves rather than rewarding shareholders with a dividend, and that in the long term it's better for shareholders?
Absolutely. The biggest mistake I think that this is just Buffett, but the biggest mistake that a company can do is either go out and make an acquisition. Actually, funnily enough, Peter Lynch used to call it diversification, not diversification, but diversification, where business A goes out and acquires business C, and it just makes a huge waste of capital. So that's one problem. So a business like Alphabet, Google, that is doing the right thing. You know, they're investing very aggressively within themselves, very aggressively preserving that balance sheet. So saying the Alphabet is very is doing the right thing in the sense that it's very wise with their capital deployment. So they are basically holding a lot of it on the balance sheet for when opportunities come up to either invest in themselves or to repurchase their own shares. I think that is the right approach. So I think the worst thing that a business can do is something hypothetically, something like IBM, where they need to deliver growth and they go out and make a huge acquisition, which the verdict is still out whether they'll make it or not. But this is the worst thing that I think a business can do is really deploy that capital, which belongs to the owners of the business, which is the shareholders. It is that I think that is the huge mistake. And also for in a different situation, but something like Visa, for example, or MasterCard, where they're making repurchases at a very elevated valuation. You're taking the money from the owner of the business, which is a shareholder, and you're just repurchasing something that's super overvalued just to keep the share prices up. And I believe that is also, it's always with the benefit of hindsight, but this will come to be that this has been a huge waste of capital. So I think that the best thing the business can do is either preserve, like basically follow Buffett's model, preserve that cash on the balance sheet. Yes, someone can say, Buffett has underperformed for the last 16 years. That is true, but he didn't get where he is today by being unwise. He's at the top of his game. He's got all that experience, and it's not about some financial journalist saying, you underperformed for the last so many X years. He's got an amazing team behind him, and he's built that. He didn't build it overnight, So I think that a lot of business could do quite well by just following his example.
Yeah. Are there a lot of companies that don't pay dividends, where all the valuation checks out, the balance sheet's in order, and they aren't repurchasing shares either?
That's a good question. Off the top of my mind, I can't think of a situation like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that, for example, a company that I just wrote about recently, so it's the top of my mind, something like Adobe, okay? So Adobe, it was quite savvy. Adobe managed to come away from being a pure play document editing company, and they came in and they made, they acquired a business, Magnento, I think it was called or something, and they're going face to face against the likes of Shopify. So this is totally different, but they've succeeded it tremendously well there. And now that they feel that the growth is not that strong, they are repurchasing their own shares. But I believe in the case of Adobe, this is a mistake to be buying up the shares so much. In fact, if you take out their stock-based compensation, account for that, and then you see how much they're repurchasing their shares. So although they're actually deploying deploying approximately 80% of their free cash flow towards repurchasing shares, but the actual shareholder, the number of shares outstanding is the same over the last 3 years. So they're just using up that capital that they should preserve, and they're buying up shares, and it's the shareholder is no better off. So I think that this is a case that maybe management could just be a bit more savvy and kind of hold off a little bit. Because, in Adobe, the cloud is just such a booming sector. And at the moment, everything is very much priced to perfection. But that does not mean that 2.5, 3 years down the road, things don't come down a little bit and there's an opportunity to be opportunistic. So I think that the best thing that a lot of companies can do that have been through this boom time is to just hold off and be patient. I think that's
fair enough. Okay, you mentioned Adobe. You did do a recent piece on them titled Adobe Fully Priced Avoid. Mm-hmm. That just published this morning, actually, as we speak here on October 22nd. I want to ask you about some specific stock picks, but I first need to take a short break. I am speaking with Michael Wiggins de Oliveira, who runs the Deep Value Research Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for the service either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Deep Value Research, or by typing Deep Value Research or Michael Wiggins de Oliveira into the site search bar at seekingalpha.com. Okay, Michael, welcome back. What is something that scares you about the markets or about your portfolio at present?
I think that the markets, the most worrisome thing is the boom in passive funds. So Vanguard, BlackRock, a lot of passive money, and there's a lot of the way that it's designed is to be company and valuation agnostic. So it's just most of the cases equally is mostly weighted by market cap. So some, I'm not a fan, but something like Amazon gets purchased regardless of its valuation, and people believe that it's easy money to be made. A lot of retail investors are buying a lot of passive funds, and I think that this is one of the cases that is technically correct to do that, but because there's just so much money being pumped, it's at some point when this bubble pops and a lot of retail investors come out of passive funds, there's going to be just such a just difficult environment where there's going to be just mass selling, and it's going to be driven by retail investors coming out of passive funds. So I think that passive funds are important. I think they do a very good job, but I'm not sure if the retail investor is going to be able to withstand that downturn when it does come. It will come. It always comes. So I think that is one thing that I'm quite cautious about. And the genius would say I would foresee it, but I'm not going to foresee it. So what I've tried to do to my own portfolio is I've just stuck to my guns. I'm buying very cheap companies with strong balance sheets that generate a lot of free cash flow. I'm just trying my hardest to be very careful with my capital deploying. And hopefully that allows me to weather the storm, because if you're buying something that's quite cheap, it will go down. Everything goes down in price, but it comes a bottom that things don't go below. It doesn't. There's a certain valuation that gets so cheap that it becomes a no-brainer, and that's your safety net. Whereas when you see something hypothetically like Amazon, that could really just fall a lot. Mm. And I don't believe that the retail investors adequately prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. What would you say are better alternatives? You mentioned, you know, picking stocks at cheap.
Yes, it's difficult. I mean, there is no alternative. Yeah. That's the problem. That is difficult. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that the average retail investor should be picking out stocks. Right. I think that is a huge mistake. Right. I think that passive funds are important. They certainly are. But I think that it's important within passive funds to be very well diversified too. Mm-hmm. So not only buying the NASDAQ and the S&P, but I think that maybe something like the MSCI World. So just a diversified basket of index funds. Yeah. I think that's the best thing that they can do.
And that's just stocks. You can also do fixed income and credit and things
absolutely
like that. Okay. What is, you've been doing this for a little while. What's something that gives you confidence in your approach?
You know, value works. Yeah. I mean, it just works. It's just common sense. So when Seth Klarman wrote his book, Margin of Safety, is 25 years old, and he talks about a little anecdote about a kind of sardines, and that people in the marketplace, and they're trading these kinds of sardines at high values. And when someone actually went and opened the kind of sardines, they're like, oh, these sardines taste awful. And the seller says, these sardines are not for eating. And what the story that he's saying is essentially that these pieces of paper that we're trading around belong to a company. And when the company gets acquired, when the company repurchases shares, or when the company gets liquidated, then those shares actually count for something. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, it doesn't feel like it does. Right. And that's why sometimes the market can become very much overvalued, and sometimes they can become very, very cheap. But that's why it realigns with intrinsic value.
Mm-hmm. Where do you view today's markets? Do you have any views on that? I mean, people are saying that it's overvalued.
I mean, it is expensive. I think that certain pockets are very, very overvalued. Mm-hmm. But I believe that there are some pockets, for example, brick and mortar, that's just been annihilated. Everyone is believing that Amazon's going to take over the planet. Right. And I think that, but you have to be very careful when you buy into retail stocks. I think that they've been through some really difficult times, and those that survive, those that are able to stay present in the next 3-4 years, for example, Costco, those are just shows the strength of the business model. Something like Walmart, you know. So I believe that there is pockets of opportunity, but you have to be willing to go where others people do not want to go for now. Mm-hmm. And I believe that there are, conversely, there are stocks like cloud stocks that are just being priced beyond perfection. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a bit of a divergence, if you will, that some stocks are really expensive, but there are some that are really, really, really cheaply priced. Now, some investors, even Charlie Munger said that things that are cheap for a reason.
Right.
Now, you know, I'm very much of a Mungerist fan, and I have followed a lot of his teachings, but I do believe that if you're selective, I still believe that there are things that are cheap that are not necessarily cheap for the correct reasons. Mm-hmm. And but it is difficult. I mean, it is very, very difficult. So I think that it is overall a very expensive market. And I mean, Joel Greenblatt talks about that the market is at the top 80th percentile. So it's pretty much fully priced as it's ever been in history. So I think that more often than not, it's been a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. But you can't wait the next 2 years. You can't wait the next 4 years for another sell-off like 2008. And even when that comes around, you don't know, maybe you go in too early. You know, like 2008 was a downturn for 2 years. It would have been it's very difficult at the time to have known to go in at the early 2008, you go in like at the end of 2009. It's very, very difficult to know when to go in. And I think that the best way to do that is having a diversified portfolio of companies with strong balance sheets.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, timing is indeed, if not impossible, then certainly extremely difficult. You mentioned mm-hmm. retail stocks. You mentioned Costco. You mentioned Walmart. Are those some of your favorite ideas? And if so, if not, what are they?
Yeah, so I have one idea at the moment that I'm very bullish on. It's called Bed Bath & Beyond, and this is a retailer. But the thing I've learned over time is that everyone wants to just do a DCF, this is a discounted cash flow analysis, and if something goes into the calculator, they're willing to purchase it, if it makes sense on a calculator. But sometimes there are things on the balance sheet that are not immediately obvious. So Bed Bath & Beyond, for example, at the moment trades for about 1.6 billion market cap. So 1.6 billion market cap. And they got rid of the CEO, Stephen Tamaris, back in May, and Legion Asset Management became activist shareholder in Bed Bath & Beyond. So Bed Bath & Beyond is worth approximately $1.6 billion, and Legion has worked together with the board, and they're doing a sale and lease back of their retail footprint. This is they're trying to see if they can sell it to Oaktree Management, which is Howard Marks' company, and they're trying to see if they can sell it for $600 million. So you got that side of the business that is doing sale and lease back, and it's doing it this quarter, or maybe it will fall into next quarter. That's $600 million. And then they're spinning off two of their business concepts, they call them. This is small business units within Bed Bath & Beyond. And they believe, the management believes, and it's been reported on in the media, that each one of these businesses might make $250 million in a sale. One of them was bought, which was Cost World, I think cost $450 when they bought it a few years back, and they're selling it at $250. So they're just really trying to do that. So you got two business units that are being sold to two different entities, and Goldman Sachs has been hired to facilitate the process. So you got these two business units that are approximately worth together $500 million, and then you got the sale and lease back that's approximately $600 million. So all together, it kind of approximately, let's say, $1 billion, but let's just take a haircut to that and say that it's $900 million. So you got just stuff coming off its balance sheet that's worth approximately $900 million in the next two quarters. So you have a company that's worth $1.6 billion. You take away the $900 million, you're worth approximately $700 million market cap. Now, Bed Bath & Beyond, if they sell these two businesses, obviously they will have less free cash flow. But at this moment in time, the free cash flow is about $450 million. So even if you make an allowance, an assumption for how much they would lose from these two units, you're probably getting Bed Bath & Beyond making about $350 million of free cash flow, even if you say $300 million. So you're only paying three times free cash flow for a business that has a very strong balance sheet, and it has a lot of spare cash coming into the business over the next two quarters. So if anyone was to look at Bed Bath & Beyond in the last month and a half, the share price has really rallied because the news has started to break out. And this is a Bed Bath & Beyond is the second or third highest shorted stock in the market at the moment. So there's a 40% short on the float. So in the event that the news was to continue to be even close to positive, people would have to close their short positions because this retailer is not going out of business, has a strong balance sheet, it makes a lot of free cash flow, and it's trading for approximately 3x free cash flow once you account for these divestments that are going to come in the next two quarters. So just have to wait around for about 6 months. And I think that the market cap might go to about 4.2 billion, which is about 26 cents per share. So I think it can make about 50% to 100% over the next 12 months. I think while doing a lot, I think that obviously you never know. As I said at the beginning of the conversation, there's always a risk. There's no point folding a lot of your stocks. And I think that you can have a 40% failure rate, but you have to be very selective. And sometimes, you get a bit of good fortune come your way and you take a position and some things work out positively. And when it does, it works out very nicely because you get a nice reward and it offsets all the other times that you didn't. So I think that you have to be humble. You have to be honest with yourself with what can happen and what cannot happen. And I think that, hope for the best.
Cool. Yeah, Bed Bath & Beyond, you mentioned it. This stock bottomed out on back on August 15th at $7.40 a share. As we speak today on October 22nd, it's up to $13.62, which is a gain of somewhat 80%. I don't even know. It's a lot. It's been a huge rally. Now, Michael, this stock does pay a dividend, almost 5%. But in this case, you don't mind?
I mean, like if it comes for free, have it. I'll have it. But it's not even a game plan. I mean, so the dividend has just, if I believe, it has just increased a little bit. But I think that is not even the problem because once that the lease and sale back of the real estate then comes in and you got the two businesses that are divested and you have approximately 800 million to 900 million of cash coming into the business and they can offset a lot of that with deferred tax assets. So they don't even have to pay a lot on the capital gains on that. So once you have about that infusion of about 800 million, you can pay down pretty much 60-70% of the debt, and this thing can be pretty much debt-free and making approximately 300 to 350 million of free cash flow. So you're paying about 3x free cash flow for a business that's going to have a net cash position on the balance sheet. And, maybe they turn around the business. I don't know if they will. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But maybe they even turn around the business. If they do turn around the business, and I mean, it's making that much free cash flow. It shouldn't be trading for 3x free cash flow. I mean, there's a lot of businesses, even within even brick and mortar, that are trading for about 8 to 10x free cash flow. So, I mean, there's a lot of upside if things go right. It's about how getting the right management in, which they try to get someone over from Target. So it's about having the right management. And the new CEO is going to start at the end of November, I think it is. So he's going to come in just for the holiday season. He's not going to have a lot of power right now. But starting January, I think that he'll hit the road running. I think that with the right management, with the right rhetoric, with the right narrative, with the numbers to back it, I think that this thing could double.
And you're not concerned long term about the Amazon effect? I mean, a lot of what Bed Bath & Beyond sells,
I think that's overdone. Yeah. I mean, because if you look at the interesting thing for me personally with Bed Bath & Beyond is if you look at the last 5 years, their revenues are close to flat. So if all the theater about Amazon destroying and Wayfair destroying Bed Bath & Beyond, for all the narrative and all the story, the revenue is pretty solidly flat. And this was a CEO, Stephen Tamaris, that was there from 2003, and he was doing some not very nice stuff with shareholder money. I'm not going to say more on him, but I mean, he wasn't particularly doing the right thing. So I think that even with all of that, if you get a decent person which is shareholder-friendly, or shareholder-oriented, I believe they might be able to stabilize the business. And if it does, this will do well. But you never know.
Very good. All right. That is good. Is there anything else about the market that you're interested in right now that you find is a good opportunity?
I think that the best way to approach a business is by trying to think how others would not think about it. So there's come on top of my head at the moment. There's a stock that I own called Intrepid Potash. Now, if I say to you, Nathaniel, about Intrepid Potash, the first thing you're going to think of is Potash. And a lot of people look at this stock and they think it's a potash company. But I'm actually not interested on the potash side of the business, although that's approximately 50% of the business. I'm willing to disregard that for free. So the markup of Intrepid Potash is approximately 460 million, less than 500 million. It's like 400, something like that, 400 million. And they're going to be making an announcement in November, which is approximately 2-3 weeks away, where they're going to give a guidance for their water sales. Now, what does water have to do with potash? So this, within Intrepid Potash, about 2 years ago, they started selling water, and they're trying to, this business went from zero to approximately 40 to 50 million of cash flows starting 2020. So this business went from nothing to approximately 40, 50 million of cash flow starting 2020. And when people think of Intrepid Potash, they just think of a potash business with cyclicality and commodity, and it's absolutely nothing to do with that. So there is a. So I think that you have to be quite discerning. I think you have to be selective, and I think you have to be quite careful not to just deploy your cash into anything. I think that it's much better to be patient and to wait out 2 months, 3 months, and keep the cash under your mattress, because when the right opportunity comes, and if you're willing to work hard, I think that right opportunities do come about, and I think that it's worthwhile deploying that cash that you've been sitting on for about 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Michael Wiggins de Oliveira, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nicole.
If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, among others, by searching for Marketplace Roundtable. You can give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. I have been speaking with Michael Wiggins de Oliveira, who runs the Deep Value Research here at SeekingAlpha.com. You can sign up for the service either by going to SeekingAlpha.com/marketplace and looking for Deep Value Research, or typing Deep Value Research or Michael Wiggins Oliveira into the site search bar at SeekingAlpha.com. You can, of course, also follow Michael on SeekingAlpha.com and enjoy his free content there. Lastly, disclosures. I, Nathaniel Baker, I do not have any positions in any of the securities mentioned on today's podcast. Michael, what about you?
So I own Intrepid Potash. I own Bed Bath & Beyond. I do not have any positions outside of that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And thank you all for listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.